House Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:17 p.m. on Wednesday, February 5th. With us, we have Representative Reinbold, Representative Josephson, Representative Sadler, Representative Heron, and myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Today is Commissioner Curtis Thayer Day, and Curtis is the only item on the agenda. He's going to give us an update of a number of things that are going on with the Department of Administration. Welcome back, and please read yourself onto the record, and it's your show.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Commissioner of the Department of Administration. Today, I wanted to update the committee on a couple of topics, primarily the Universal Space Standards, also labor contracts, and any other questions that you might have pertaining to the department. With me also in the audience is Andy Mills, Special Assistant, and Sherry Lowenstein, our Admin Services Director. Oh, she's going to be my Vanna White.
Who's behind door number one?
That's Carol Merrill.
The first thing with the department is we're kind of a department within a department. We have 10 different divisions and 5 commissions, and quite frankly, very few relate to each other. We have everything, as this would indicate, from services to the public, which are Division of Motor Vehicles, to a public defender, to the Division of Finance, to the Division of Admin Services or Enterprise Technologies for the state. It is across the board, and then we also have the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, along with Public Broadcasting and the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission that reports to us up administratively. So we're a very diverse department. We have about a little over 1,000 employees, and our budget is $343 million. We provide services across the state with primarily, when you see it, with 31 locations. A lot of those are DMV locations, obviously. There's 31 of those. And then also our public defenders. Public defenders anywhere from Barrow, Kotzebue, rural Alaska, Unalaska, all the way down to Ketchikan. We also have the Office of Public Advocacy has several offices. And then we also own, and we'll be discussing, we own 15 public buildings. And those public buildings are here in Juneau, Anchorage, Palmer, across the state, as in there in the public building fund. First thing I wanted to bring up today was labor contracts and kind of give you an overview of where we are with contracts. The state bargains, this year we're bargaining five contracts. Three are maritime unions. One is with AVTAC, and then Public Safety, Employees Association, State Troopers, Court Officers. And last year, we had negotiated with GGU, which is the largest employees, and also Supervisory and Confidential Employees Union. So contracts are on a three-year term, so they're constantly rotating who we're negotiating with. We bargain according to PARA, which is in statute, and we usually start our bargaining in October. And it continues on, and by statute, we are to have an agreement to the legislature for their consideration by the 60th day of session. We met that last year with all three contracts. It is our goal that we also have these contracts for you by the 60th day of session. I actually hope that, and we can talk about it, I hope that with one of the unions, I think we might be able to get it to you this month. We're very close. So we'll go right there. If negotiations do not lead to an agreement, just so we understand, there's usually mediation fails, employees have the right to strike. This particular year, though, with state troopers, they do not have the right to strike. They're class one. We go into binding arbitration with them. With the Marine Highway workers, most likely if we were to do that, there would be an injunction and they would be required to go back to work within 3 days because of life and safety of the Marine Highway system. But again, we would continue negotiating with them. It is not our intention to go down that path, but it is the path of if something doesn't happen. And our goal is to reach fair and balanced agreements for that. And this slide I kind of jumped to, and that was the strike one, strike two, and strike three class. So strike one, the strike class one is the public safety, and strike two would be the Alaska Marine Highway System. Strike three primarily where the contracts were negotiated last year, GGU and SU and confidential employees. When we look at our bargaining units, these were listed according to the year in which we bargained. This year, with Alaska Vocational Technical Teachers Association, there's 41 employees in that bargaining unit. We have Inman Boatman Union, which is about 669. MEBA, which is Marine Engineers, is about 107. And Master Mates and Pilots, just at 98. And then Public Safety Employees Association, about 509. So when you look at this year, we're negotiating with 1,400 employees, where last year we had negotiated with almost 12,000 employees. One thing with we'll go to the next slide. The next slide is what our average salary are for these positions. And again, these are listed in the year in which we bargain, just so they're easier to point out. But our Vocational Teachers Association is roughly about $76,000 per employee. Inman Boatman's $51,000. Our Marine Engineers is $73,000. And our Master Mates and Pilots are $85,000. And then you do add 49% on top of that for benefits. And so this particular year, we're negotiating in public safety at $84,000. We are negotiating this year with very highly compensated employees. I will say, and there will be a later slide on this, Master Mates and Pilots, they are highest paid in state government. Some of their salaries are approaching $180,000 to $190,000.
Can we take questions while we're going
sure,
along, or Representative Rainbow?
Okay, I've got a couple questions just to start off with. I want to start off last year first. You said you guys did Senate Bill 95. Mm-hmm. I know you carried that bill. As a result of Senate Bill 95, what is the long-term cost to the state, number one, and how is that going to affect our long-term PERS and TERS unfunded liability?
Well, we can get you that information more in detail, but with the ones that we had negotiated, we're coming up on 50% of our employees are in defined contribution. They're not in PERS and TERS, so we need to get that breakdown for you. As far as the overall cost last year, we will provide that with you. One thing I would note is last year was the largest take back we had with employees, because last year we had the increase of a 1-1, 2.5. We were able to negotiate a reduction in merit.
Can I
follow up?
Okay, just I understand. I've heard that. What I just want to know, the question was very clear. What was the fiscal note on it that you know of, and what is the cost to the state of Senate Bill 95, and how is it going to affect long-term PERS and TERS unfunded liability?
Through the chair, I will get you that information, Representative Reinbold. I do not have it with me.
And as follow-up, please? Okay, follow-up. You on page 9, you have, like, IBU, and you have the average salary. What is the breakdown of the number of employees, you know?
Page 4.
So there's 41 of the VOTEC Technical Teachers Association?
Yes, through the chair. Yes, Representative Reinbold.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
One thing with this.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you used the term take back. Can you tell me, you talked about the 1, 1.5, 2.
Right.
I mean, what does take back mean?
Well, thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Representative Josephson. One of the things that we did is we did the COLA, the cost of living, of a 1, 1, 2.5. But we worked with the unions, and a couple of the issues and concerns we had was on our unfunded leave liability, which is a later slide on. Mm-hmm. We did not have a cap on leave. Employees could accumulate an unlimited amount of leave and then be able to cash that leave out, where we had employees that had $200,000 to $300,000 worth of leave. We negotiated a cap on that of 1,000 hours. So employees can't go over that amount. We also increased the amount of mandatory usage of leave from 1 week to 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then if you had 3 years, or you had a 400 hours in your leave bank, you had to take 3 weeks of leave or cash 1 week in. Mm-hmm. So it was to increase the usage to keep people below that cap. And then also for new hires, we negotiated a lower leave accrual rating for new hires that were effective July 1st of 2000.
I remember now.
Yeah, 2013. And then also, we also have the merit increases that employees receive after several years of service, and it was 3.75. We negotiated that down to 3.25 in outlying years. And so there was, and that was one of the reasons why you have the 1, 1, 2.5, because part of that was we bought back that particular cost as far as the merit. And then for the largest union we had, which was GGU, the state was paying a premium into their health trust of about $700-$800 per member per mm-hmm. year. And that cost was approximately $20 million. So we paid one time for that in a lump sum and then reduced that cost, and we no longer owe that premium. So that alone saved the state $14 million, mm-hmm. and it's no longer an obligation we pay for in the future. So those were some of the issues that we negotiated across the table.
Follow up or new question?
Well, just a comment. I mean, you're, it does strike me, even though I'm a fan of public workers, mm-hmm. and I hope I'm getting known to be that, because I take pride in it. $200,000 is an enormous amount of, it's another retirement is what it is, of leave. But under this system, we're going to have more absent workers. Isn't that right? I mean, people will be exercising their leave rights more liberally.
Through the chair, I believe that would be correct, because we had required one week of leave, and now it's two and possibly three. But we're also in a position where if you have somebody who is required to take 3 weeks of leave, they're also earning 6 weeks of leave according to it. So we don't no longer have sick leave. We have personal time off. And so one thing the employees have is, you know, as they go in state service, they get up to 6 weeks. And when we were requiring only 1 week, they could bank 5 weeks. Mm-hmm. And that's why we were getting such large leave balances, yes.
Yeah. I mean, I guess just to follow, it would be impossible to measure the impact on the functioning of government is all I'm trying to suggest. If people are exercising their leave, I wouldn't expect you to know what the impact would be. Thank you.
Representative Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, the information you can provide from my friend from the Eagle River Valley will go to the chair and then it'll distribute it. Could you also add in that information the breakdown of where all these employees live and work?
Yeah. Through the chair, yes, we can provide that
Thank
information.
You.
One thing on this slide that I'd like to note is, as we're negotiating, the IBU, the Inman Boatman's Union, 10% of their workforce reside outside the state of Alaska. When you look at MMP, which is the Master Mates and Pilots, about 20% of that workforce lives outside of Alaska. But really, when you get to the Marine Engineers, 40% of that workforce lives outside Alaska. It's a very interesting statistic that we have run across, and it is a concern as we bargain. Sometimes our interests are differently aligned, because 40% of the workforce doesn't live in Alaska, so 40% of them doesn't necessarily understand some of the cost constraints and some of our issues that we have in the operation of the ferry system.
Would that include the Ocean Rangers under MEBA, or who did?
Through Mr. Chair, I believe it does, yes.
Yeah, I believe the Ocean Rangers, it was 90% were living outside, if I recall right.
We'll confirm that number. The other thing that's important to note when we talk about the marine vessel operations is through this, through the various years through 2005, 2014, in blue you see the total revenue the marine highway system brings in. In green is what the personnel services cost are, and in red you have the total expenditure of the marine highway system. So going into 2014, it is anticipated that the marine highway system will lose $117 million, is what the state subsidized that. And primarily the largest driver of that is personnel cost. And so that is one of the things when we are negotiating with the unions that we bring up. We have this. They've had a presentation. We really drive home this point that we as a state cannot necessarily afford to continue on this trend.
Just to be clear,
Representative Joseph, followed by Representative Reinbold.
So I mean, fundamentally, what you're saying about the marine highway system is it's we have to subsidize it like mm-hmm. crazy. That's the essence of it.
Through the chair, yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Reinbold, and then Representative Heron.
Looks like we've been on this trend for a long time. I mean, if this was private sector, this wouldn't make it. So what are your plans to fix this?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold. Department Administration, we're negotiating the contracts, but we work very closely with DOT. DOT is the agency responsible for the marine highway system. We've been working with them on operational issues and as try to work with the personnel cost, but the fundamental operation of the marine highway system is a question for the Department of Transportation.
Okay, so if I'm hearing you clearly, there's no plan to fix this.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the Department of Administration negotiates contracts. Department of Transportation, Department of Administration negotiates the contracts with DOT. DOT runs the highway system. The question is more appropriately for Department of Transportation.
Final, $117 million. Did you say we're going to go in the hole in this? It's very unsustainable.
Through the chair, yes.
Very.
Yes.
Very, very. I hope this is definitely, I'd like to know what the plan is to fix this.
Bye. One for me. Does the $117 million include the fuel?
Include.
Usually the fuel comes in at two or three times what we have in the budget.
Mr. Chair, yes, it does. Another slide.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Herring.
Commissioner, this example of expenses versus revenue example, could you please provide another PowerPoint page that says, looks at how much we spend on expenses on the highway system, not the marine highway system, but the regular highway system, how much we spend on expenses and how much we make in revenues?
Okay, if you go to the next slide. This slide might help answer that question.
I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Chenault.
With this particular slide, this is a per capita transportation cost, and the number of primary users on the highway system is approximately 675,000. The net cost to the state is a little over $28 million, and so the cost per capita per that uses the highway system is $42. The rural aviation is about 206,000 users, with a net cost to the state of approximately $43 million. So the cost per capita is 166. And when we come to the Alaska Marine Highway System, there's approximately 107,000 users. The net cost to the state is 118,000, which is the number we're talking about, the subsidization, which gives the cost per capita cost of $1,100. It costs the state for every rider that we have on the Marine Highway System.
Mr. Chairman,
follow up.
Mr. Commissioner, but I want you to put it in the context of page 10. Is three using that graph, total expenditures, personal cost, and total revenue. Could you please demonstrate the highway system using number 10 as the graph?
Mr. Chair, I will attempt to do so, but this was out of the university study, and we don't charge for the use of our highway system, and so it's a little different, but I will work with DOT to see if we can come up with the graph you're looking for.
I think that's the point that I was getting at, Mr. Chairman, is that I'd like to see what shows how much revenue the highway system generates.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner Designee. Can you give a rough cut as to how many of the ferry users are Alaska residents and how many are visitors from outside?
Through the chair, we will get that from the Department of Transportation.
You had to take a rough guess.
I do not. We not do ticket sales, but we can get that for you.
It's not in your job description.
Thank you. Commissioner Thayer, I met a young woman who's a constituent last year in my office, and she worked for DHSS on, I think, Medicaid enforcement or Medicaid applications. And she told me that she was an itinerant person who would leave Anchorage, her hometown. She would travel to a regional center like Nome or Bethel. She would leave on a Sunday night, and she would frequently leave on a Sunday night or arrive at the airport at 5:30 in the morning Monday. And I asked her, I said, well, surely when you get back Wednesday night, you get Thursday off. She said, no such thing happened. And we had a long conversation because there was a vast amount of uncompensated time. Is this something that's been a subject of bargaining? Or is it something that you're aware of?
Through the chair, it is something that has been discussed generally in bargaining, but it has not been a point of bargaining. It has not been an issue where there's been any proposals, at least in the last bargaining session, from any of the three unions we negotiated with, and I would imagine she most likely would have fit under the general government unit. But it was not an issue that they brought to the table, and it's not something that we've negotiated in contracts.
Okay. Paul? Is my sort of recitation of a category of employee, is it believable? I mean, are you aware of workers like that?
Through the chair, I think we saw a lot of them at the General Airport the last couple of weeks.
Okay.
it's very hard. We try very much with employees, and we've encouraged when they travel, that you travel, try to travel during business hours. But inevitably, depending on where you travel and where the flight connections are, you take earlier flights. It's something that they can work with their supervisor with, depending on it. But it is not something that is part of of the contract or bargaining.
Thank you.
Representative Reinbold.
Okay. continue on page 10, the green, it looks like, is personnel services. I would guess that was the union contracts. Is that correct?
Through the chair, primarily, yes.
Okay. So if you look at 2014, roughly it's $90 million in personnel costs, which is union negotiating contracts. And if you look at the total, it's about $150 million it's costing to operate the ferry system. Mm-hmm. So roughly, it appears that the Department of Administration would be roughly working with about half of the total, which is the $90 million dollars of contracts. Who is on the contracting team on the state beside yourself that does those negotiations, those contract negotiations for the state?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold. We have employees that are within the Labor Relations, Division of Personnel and Labor Relations. They sit in the first chair and second chair are the primary negotiators from the state. We also have employees with the Marine Highway System, including the Deputy Commissioner Yost, is sitting on two of the three bargaining teams. So there's management from DOT there. It's very helpful to have DOT at the table because there's very complex business rules on how we operate the system, scheduling works, how the vessels move, staffing on the vessels, and so it's very important that DOT be there and part of the negotiations because it's their employees, and they manage those employees.
Sure. Okay. So just as a closeout, so I would like as a follow up, hopefully you can send it to Crystal Keenum and my staff.
Okay, send it in to us, and we'll send it out to all the committee members.
Okay. So the long term 20-year projection of Senate Bill 95, and also. If you could get us a list of who's on the negotiating team.
Through the chair, I can do that. There's three. Would you like all five negotiating teams,
sure.
Or would you like the three that were currently the three maritime?
All, please.
Okay.
And I might add for anybody in the room that virtually within minutes of when we receive something like we'd be receiving from the commissioner, we post it on the Labor and Commerce site, and it becomes. Goes out to anybody in the world that wants it at that point in time.
When we, couple of items, since we are in negotiations, negotiations are confidential in nature, but a couple of things that we have discussed publicly, and they are in the current contracts, and that is we want to address COLD, which is the cost of living differential. That it applies to residents. COLD was established in 1977 that basically said that there was a cost of living differential between Seattle and Anchorage. And for some employees, it amounts to $450 to $650 a pay period. That has, I think it could be argued we have studies that we've negotiated into our contracts that there is no difference in cost of living. Between Anchorage and Seattle. So that is something that we're looking at and working with the bargaining teams on. It is something that we do want addressed. Another one is travel pay, and that is the pay for the time spent traveling outside the work hours to temporary work assignments. I think it goes to Representative Josephson's. The maritime unions have that in their contract. We don't have it with any other employees. Contracts, and we want to try to get some more alignment. Then there's the issue of non-watch pay, which is paid in lieu of certain overtime entitlements to a higher level employee. They're not eligible for overtime, so they get watch pay. And those are a couple of those issues that we're trying to work with the Marine Highway System in bargaining to address those.
Representative Reinbold.
Okay, thank you. This is just really interesting to me, the cost of living on page 12, that you said that there was no differentiation in some studies. And that brings me back to Senate Bill 95, which I had issue with that. There was a in the back, a chart where, like, Juneau got 5%, and I believe it was Barrow 60%. There was a vast, and we had asked you please to come back and bring justification for those that you said you were going to clearly look. Unfortunately, it avoided my committee regulatory because it was exempted as part of the bill. So I would definitely like to see that cost of living and how that was justified.
Through the chair, Representative Rumble, we can provide that. It was a study in 2008. It's been negotiated into the majority of our contracts now, and we can provide that. One thing that study did show is the cost of living in Seattle and Anchorage is zero. There was a cost of living differential in different various parts of Alaska. You're correct. Juneau saw 5% geodiff, and then Fairbanks, for example, saw a reduction from 11% to 4%. And so the study was across the board, and we'd be more than glad to have you to provide that study for you.
Thank you.
Sure. Representative Sadler.
Brief question, Mr. Commissioner. Under travel pay, is travel pay paid at straight time, or is it a fraction of an hourly pay?
Through the chair, it's straight time. One thing when we look at monetary terms when discussing this with the Marine unions, if we were to give a 1% raise for FY15, the cost would be about $500,000. But when you look at that cumulatively over 3 years compounded, it's $5 million. Same is true with Marine engineers. It's a smaller union, as is master mates and pilots. But quickly, you realize that a 1% raise is worth $8 million. And so that is something, you know, it's easy. I think it's been easy to say 1% or something like that. But when you look at it, it's real dollars. It is something where we are particularly concerned with. And then also when you have the COLD payments in addition to it, COLD cost the state in the Inman Boatman's Union about $8 million and then about $1 million each for Master Mates and Pilots and MEBA. So that's $10 million going out to a 1977 study that's in statute. So that is those are some of the challenges when you're bargaining, when we're negotiating with stuff in statute that's 37 years old. So it is something that we continue to work with.
So conceivably that could be updated by statute as well?
Conceivably, yes, it could.
Not this year, I don't think, though.
I think one thing that's important to note is when you look at the COLAs over time for these bargaining units, in 2007 through 2013, the Master Mates and Pilots in MEBA has received a 31% increase during that time period. There was also in 2008 a lump sum that rather than a percentage salary, they received a lump sum. IBU received similar. But over their course, it's 33% plus $2,100. In comparison, PSEA, now I need to put a disclaimer on PSEA. They would have received a 25% increase during that same time. However, they have merit and pay increments, which is where they have the 3.75 that we negotiated as 3.25, but that is every year for the first 5 years of employment and then every 2 years after. So when you actually look at PSA, they're probably closer to over 50% pay increase in those 10 years. Ironically, also to note, the largest years that MEBA and Master Mates and Pilots received was during the Murkowski years, 7%, 6%, and 6%. And then it was negotiated down. And then in 2011, 12, and 13, those particular unions had no increase whatsoever in cost of living. And MEBA and Master Mates and Pilots and IBU do not have merit or pay increments. What they negotiate is their cost of living, and it's a straight. There's no other incentive or no other pay that they receive.
I'm struck by, first of all, this is fascinating. And I haven't been to an overview like this one. It's interesting that there were no pay increases in 11 and 12 and 13 when we were particularly flush. How do you explain that?
through the chair, I can find, I wasn't on the negotiating teams there, I wasn't in the Department of Administration when the contract was negotiated, and but I can find that information out. We have notes, we have a little bit of history. I don't know. Sometimes the negotiation of a contract, there's language, there's operational issues that are more of a concern to an employee group than actual the wages are. And the one thing is the earlier slides show, they're a very highly compensated group of employees. And so sometimes they will negotiate something different within their contract as opposed to a wage increase.
And that's to keep something existing that they don't want to negotiate on, or
precisely, it could be something with their leave, it could be something on scheduling, an operational issue, how we treat shift differentials, something like that. There could be a numerous issues. Normally, it's done in packages.
And just to be clear, in fact, this came through Labor and Commerce last year. Some of these workers are, for example, the pilots. They are effectively the captain of large cruise ships that come into a
harbor. These are all Marine Highway workers. They're not the pilots of the cruise ship.
That's a separate
organization. Okay. I will say this, I happen to chair the Board of Marine Pilots in my spare time.
All right.
the Board of Marine Pilots, what you usually have is you have retired captains, a lot of them from the Marine Highway system, so when they do retire, then they go through the Southeast Pilots Association or one of those to qualify to be a pilot on one of the larger vessels. It's a much more lucrative business.
They're independent contractors, aren't they?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, that is correct.
Representative Reinbold.
Okay. Just want to discuss the merit. It's in statute, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I guess what I want to find out is typically in the private sector, they'll rate someone a 1 possibly for high performance, a 2 average performance, and a 3 for low performance. And their merit raises typically are linked to their performance. Is that the way, or are these just automatic raises to everybody regardless of performance?
The way that it is set up is you do not, if you receive less than a satisfactory rating, then you do not receive your merit increase, but your supervisor has to give you that. That is generally on your steps A through F. So if you're an A, B, C, D, you do not require to have a performance evaluation, and the state uses a system of 1 through 7. Once you reach the F step and your pay, you're in your merit system where it's every 2 years, you have to have an evaluation. If you do not have an evaluation, you do not get your raise. So it is something that we're constantly working with the supervisors to get that in, because what does happen is sometimes they'll wait 6 months after it was due, and then we have to go retro with the employee for the money that was when they should have had their anniversary date. I will say, and it's something that with personnel and labor relations, we do not I don't believe the state has a robust evaluation of their employees. I think evaluations are good. I think evaluations are one that helps monitor employees to determine whether there's issues. But the way that the pay system is set up, the first 6 years, you don't need one to get your raise unless you're doing unsatisfactory. To me, you need to know where your strengths and your weaknesses are. Your supervisors need to know that. And it's some departments, and I will say that some departments are better than others. There's some departments in state government are fantastic at getting their evaluations in, others not so much.
So, for all practical purposes, almost everybody gets the raises, or do you have a tiny percentage that don't? But it just sounds like, for all practical purposes, everybody gets the raise pretty much.
Through the chair, for the most fact, you are correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Page 15.
This slide, again, is just to kind of put a little bit in perspective. When we talk about the top three earners, with the master mates and pilots, the top three masters earn in the ones one the top three are one you know what roughly over $165,000. The chief engineer and the first assistant, the MEBA, they range from 161 to 183. We've broken that out between regular pay, premium pay, and other pay, which would be cashed out leave and such. IBU. Remember, the average was 51,000. Yet we have some of these employees 116 to 138,000 dollars, and then PSA for troopers. We have a couple in the $200,000 range. Those ones I would like to highlight is because they are usually in rural Alaska, so there's a geodiff applied to it, and the particular one that's at $202,000, that particular officer has sea duty. Since he's in Dutch Harbor, there's also sea duty, which is a premium pay in which they receive. But those are the top salaries for the unions that we're negotiating right now, just to put it in perspective of where these employees are.
Representative Sadler?
Commissioner, sea duty as in at the ocean, blue water sea duty?
Yeah. Through the chair, yes. Okay. They are actually operating a boat or fish and wildlife or something of that nature, but yes.
So they're out of the coastal waters?
They're out of the coastal waters. Also, within Alaska, they tend to work more overtime because there's not as much shift relief necessarily for them. This slide was seen last year, but as we negotiate caps of leave, I will point out that the maritime unions have a cap on their leave already. It wasn't something we're negotiating. It's something they currently have. And then last year when we negotiated with the other unions, hopefully this time next year we will come forward with an FY14 that will show a reduction. I think we've reached our threshold of $169 million, and that is if every employee cashed out their leave bank, that is the obligation of the state. But with the increased mandatory usage and putting a cap on how much one can accumulate, I think we'll start to see that shift down. We do that from December to December. And so the new leave rules went into effect of December 13. And so our first measure is going to be December of 2014.
Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, back on the previous page, just looking at the MEBA chief and engineer, I know what premium pay is. Can you explain to me what constitutes other pay?
Through the chair, Mr. Speaker, it's usually cash leave or they've cashed out leave. So they've had leave in their leave bank and they've cashed it out.
Okay.
Which is available to all employees.
Right. Well, I just see you have one, two, three that are at the $20,000 range and one at 10. Just interested in what the other pay was. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Thayer. Is it possible that some workers can't take leave because this was my experience as a state employee? It was essentially impossible because the workload was such. For example, as a state prosecutor in Kotzebue, I mean, I could have been sanctioned by the court had I left virtually at any time, and so the leave piled up. Is that part of what's going on with state workers? Is there enough cover so that the jobs move along in the absence of the state worker?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think it really depends on what your job function is in state government. Clearly, there's some that have more available for relief. One thing that we did put into the contracts, and that is there is a provision that if you're unable to take your mandatory usage, you can carry that forward with the approval of your supervisor and the commissioner of the department. So there is kind of a checks and balances that we don't have employees say, I couldn't take it, so I'm carrying it over. There's a process in which the supervisor verifies that leave was denied or they were unable to take the leave due to work or caseload, and they do not, and they don't, they're held harmless in that regard for the leave.
Thank you.
On page 17, we have a leave liability example, and this is where we have the concern. When we talk about the $169 million leave liability, these 10 employees here represent $1.6 million. And so when you look at it, and the reason this slide's in here, it's across state government. A supervisory has 3,810 hours. They can cash it out at the annualized hourly rate, which is the value of their leave is $240,000. Ironically, the confidential employee, which is number six on your list, has the most amount of hours, 4,469 hours.
2 years.
and with this, but their salary rate is $31. So because of that, they're number six on our list. But again, it's across the supervisor. You know, with these negotiations, we're working with the supervisory, which has been negotiated a cap, public safety, we're working in negotiations with them, and general government, we had negotiated a cap, and confidential, we negotiated a cap. correctional officers are up for negotiations next year, and we will also be striving to put them in the same situation as far as negotiating a cap for those employees.
Representative Reinbold.
Okay. This is a lot. This is only 10. You know, this is only 10 employees. And, you know, we all day long, I've been sitting in meetings with education, hearing about teachers getting laid off. All day long, I've been hearing about fetal alcohol syndrome, about those many people across the state that have need. This is really hard, you know, to look at right now, when we know that there's teachers that are getting ready to get laid off. I guess, to me, this was possibly negligence on the side of the negotiators, you know, that they didn't fix these loopholes of this wouldn't happen in the private sector. And so I guess I would be a huge proponent for these negotiations to go public.
Don't these go back to statehood?
Yeah, Representative Olson, or through the chair, Representative Reinbold. These leave liabilities, I agree with you. This was the 800-pound gorilla in the room when we walked into negotiations. This is what the state negotiated. This is what Bright Light brought to the subject. When we sat down with the unions and we showed them these leave and we showed them this liability and we showed $169 million, that's what we negotiated. And quite frankly, I will give my hats off to the unions. There was no buyback. We didn't buy this 1,000-hour cap. We sat down at the table, we both saw the problem, and we both came up with a solution. We were the only state of the union not to have a cap on leave. We looked at that. I looked at New York. I looked at California. The state had the most liberal. And one of the reasons was is the state used to have sick leave. They used to have annual leave. And then there was an abuse, people perceived abuse, about 12 years ago of the sick leave. So then the state went to personal time, and everybody has the personal time off. What was not negotiated 12 years for reasons I do not know, and I surely don't want to, the bargaining table, I don't know what was going on at the time, but they didn't negotiate a cap. It wasn't until we ran these statistics last year did we realize, and we looked at these numbers and negotiated and sat down and reached a cap that we all agreed to. I agree with you, because what you'll see next time, what you're eventually going to see, These employees are no longer, they're not going to have 34,000 hours of leave. The most is going to be 10,000. We cut that by two-thirds in setting down last year. That's why last year negotiation, especially in this area, was extremely well done by the negotiating team and the unions.
As a wrap-up, thank you for identifying it, and thank you for bringing it to the table that at least it's exposed, you know, and that it was addressed. I certainly wish it would have been addressed sooner. Yeah. But with all due respect, using California, who's going down the tubes, that's exactly what I'm trying to mm-hmm. stop. And everybody has a stake at that. Everybody in the state has a stake in that. That's what we're trying to prevent. So I hope everybody will negotiate, you know, for our future, not you know, who can ever grab the most right now. But we need to, you know, for the future of our state. So we have money for education. So we have money for the elderly if there's a disaster in the state. But if we continue on this $717 million, you know, shortfalls, we're never going to be safe in our future.
Representative Olson, through the chair, Representative Olson, I can't agree with you more. You know, and this is where, you know, I look at last year when we negotiated with SB 95, 13,000 employees now have cap on their leave. That before had no cap. Mm-hmm. This year we're negotiating. The Marine Highway already has a cap, and then we're working with Public Safety right now, and we're in negotiations with them, but we're having very productive negotiations on a cap. They understand it, and we point to last year, and realizing that and it's something I've said to them, and that is I think in order for a contract to go forward to be approved by the legislature, it has to have a cap. That's what we did last year, and that's what we expect no less.
Thank you.
This year.
Well, although I agree that, there's little doubt that if the public, and I couldn't blame Representative Reinbold if she did it, if the public was aware of these statistics, they'd be alarmed. But, of course, the numbers are going to be somewhat comparable. People are just going to be exercising leave more, right? Unless you've a chunk of this is people who just either really liked their work, felt good, didn't need sick leave, didn't want to go to Disneyland, and they just grind it out hour after hour. Isn't that a large part of this?
Representative Olson, or through the chair, Representative Josephson, why necessarily employees may, you know, kept their leave, I don't necessarily know. We have a cap where no employee can hit 1,000. Once they hit 1,000 hours, that leave is reduced either through usage or whether they cash it out. But we won't run these live leave these high leave balances. What we tend to find is employees, as they get closer to retirement, they save their leave. That's just why they can, you know, they, you know, walking away with close to $250,000 in addition to their retirement benefits, that was an incentive. Mm-hmm. You know, on the same sense, it's bad on the state that we didn't work closer, because I think that we as a state, when we talk with employees about retirement benefits, getting an Uncle Sam taking a bite out of $240,000, employees should be looking at deferring that and cashing their leave out and utilizing their leave. But if they want to cash it out retirement, do it and put it into a tax-free account and let it grow. But if you have an employee here with $240,000, the most you can do is $22,500. And they're still earning 6 weeks of leave, mm-hmm. it's going to take this employee 8-10 years mm-hmm. to get that balance into a tax-deferred account. So part of it is, I think, retirement planning mm-hmm. That we should have done early to say, don't keep these large leave balances. You know, if you're looking at it for retirement, there's ways to do it. Sure. But now we have a cap on it, and they won't. These high balances won't exist in the future. I think with this particular slide, we've gone through a lot of it as far as the Marine units. Obviously, fiscally prudent cost of living increases, decreases. Operational flexibility within the Marine Highway system. Another issue is to address the conflict of interest on board vessels between masters and fellow union members. The masters are the skippers. They are the master of the vessel. But we obviously want to make sure that the union members realize that, and at the same time, same thing with evaluations and discipline. We're also looking at the elimination or limit of pass privileges for Marine Highway workers for their dependents and family members. I know that's been a bone of contention with the legislature. It's something we've heard. It's something we've addressed. We're trying to work at the bargaining table on that. Another issue is to eliminate cash draws on vessels. In the Marine contract, if you work on the Marine Highway system and while the vessel's under sale, you can go down to the purser and you can get $1,000 against your paycheck in cash. There's no reason for that. We're carrying a huge liability. Some vessels are carrying $50,000 or more to do that. Quite frankly, that's what an ATM machine is called. And we need to get it out of the contracts because, again, it's an operational issue. It doesn't cost a lot of money, but the liability is huge. And we shouldn't be operating a bank for our employees on these vessels. Also, we want to obviously voluntary and balanced agreements. If a strike occurs, we want to continue and provide essential services to citizens. And also, we're working to clarify the limitations of the right to strike or crossing a picket line. We're not there yet. I don't think we are. This is February. We got plenty of time to negotiate. But also, we're clearing. You know, we want to make sure that if something does go awry, that we're prepared for it. The next one was with public safety. I think with public safety, if you look at the contracts that were approved last year, that's the general path that we're going through with our public safety because they are very close to those negotiations, and that is the cost of living increases, be prudent, reduce the cost of longevity steps, the pay increments, reduce the legacy cost of leave liability. There's some providing some increased operational flexibility as far as some of the operations with within public safety. And again, voluntary and balanced agreements. I will say this, of the unions we're negotiating with, other than AVTAC, this is the one where I think that we're close to an agreement. We fundamentally understand where our boundaries are, and clearly the legislature, by their approval of the three previous contracts, have kind of said we want caps. We want to limit leave. And so that's the direction that we're going also with that one, and also the pay increments. Next steps, and I think this one we can kind of quickly go through, and that is we'll submit monetary terms to you. You can give us the thumbs up, thumbs down, and we're going to have it to you. It is my personal goal to have it to you by the middle of March, which is required by statute.
Not by Easter.
Not by Easter. Not by Easter, and we did have one union.
I'm not there by Easter.
We did have one union that asked what dates are we going to set up to negotiate in April and May, and I said we're not negotiating in April and May. You can pick whatever date you want. I'll meet you at the table, but it's going to be prior to the middle of March. So that's what we're holding true to.
Any more questions for Curtis before we go to Universal Space Standards? And thanks again for bringing this to us. I'm sure it's going to generate a lot of questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we do have our homework here. The next issue that's been a topic of discussion is Universal Space Standards. I think that this is something where we have not seen government move as fast. The governor's office had put out a memo outlining space standards to the commissioners December 17th, and now we're a little over a year later, and we've implemented it, and we're starting to implement it here in the Juno building, in the state office building, and we've implemented it on several floors of the Atwood building. And with space standards, what that is we anticipate we can save conservatively $125 million over the next 20 years on lease cost. We have been working with our Western States Contracting Alliance to identify contracts for office furniture, systems furniture. The state previously was spending anywhere from $8,000 to $10,000, sometimes $12,000 for an office cubicle for somebody when it came time to replace it. And now we have $6,500 working and leveraging those contracts. When we talk about space standards, and we'll go through it, if it doesn't make fiscal sense, we don't do it. It's something that we look at the term of the lease of the building. We look at our lease cost. We look at what the new lease cost would be. What is the reduction of the footprint versus the cost of the construction of doing it? And is there a monetary payback in the state? And where we've implemented that monetary payback is sometimes as short as 5 years, sometimes as long as 7 or 10. If there's not a monetary payback, we don't do it. Primarily, as we'll talk a little bit more, we're focusing on state-owned facilities right now. We look at our lease buildings, but we look at the buildings that we own and where we can find efficiencies. Also, this is with this particular slide. This kind of shows a before standards and after standards. It's the same location you were standing. This is in the Atwood building. Those offices were designed to be an accounting firm when the state moved in 20 years ago. And to maximize them, we tore down the walls. We put up systems furniture. We moved some interior offices. What we're discovering is there's better airflow with the fewer walls. There's more natural light. One thing we're doing is we're not having offices next to the windows. This particular floor, there were 20 private offices on the windows, and the employees were on the inside. The only way they saw natural daylight was if somebody in that one of those offices had the door open. And now we've reduced those down to 4 private offices due to the nature of those job functions, and all the employees now are set by the window. And ironically, one of the complaints we had is we had them all facing with their back to the window, and one of the complaints the employee says, can we face the other way? Sure, they can face the other way. But the employees are liking it. The other issue is with shared printers, scanners, and copiers. We have General Services, which is in our department. They went to shared copiers, and they all had individual printers on their desk. They've gone to shared copiers. They anticipate that with between paper and toners and repairs, they're saving approximately $30,000 to $40,000 a year just on the equipment. And this is with 30-some people.
Commissioner?
Yes.
Would it be possible to set up tours of the SOB?
Yes.
I know probably most of us have been through the floors they've done at the Atwood building, but we probably have people that haven't been to either one and have absolutely no idea what you're talking about, but you've got a building that's probably 40 yards from here that is an example. Maybe we could set something up.
Mr. Olson, Chairman Olson, when you would like to do that, we will make that happen. One thing that, and just that, is every time we do space standards in a location, we have an open house for the employees so they can come and see what it's like. You know, whether it was we've done Department of Revenue in Anchorage, one of their floors. We've also done corrections and also the Division of Insurance in Anchorage, and they've always been open for tours. Once the employees move in, not as much, but we do have a facility over here where it is General Services, and we can make that happen. One other thing that we're encouraging, and we've encouraged it before, but this is even more so, and that is a clean desk policy. You know, and some of the employees kind of got excited about what a clean desk policy is. Basically, you don't have confidential information left at your desk at the end of the day.
No, we're exempt, aren't we?
What's that?
We're exempt, aren't we?
Luckily, you're the legislature and we're the administration, so your rules are your rules. But that's one of the things. That's one of the primary things that we've worked to encourage employees to do. With this, you know, and where this has become a concern is the state. Whether it's the buildings that we manage or whether it's the leases that we administer office buildings, it totals over $70 million is what we pay a year in lease cost. So this is the reason why it is so important that we look at space. And this is one thing that we have to look at. And you make these decisions. But either you have a choice of it's going to cost the programs, it's going to cost the people, or the space in which they work. And so let's address the space and try to reduce our costs there. This particular slide just indicates the various buildings that we do own, anywhere from the Atwood office building, the parking garage, Fairbanks Regional State Office Building, Palmer, the Diamond Courthouse across the street. The third floor of this building, we operate that, obviously, as it being the governor's floor. It comes out of our...
I believe we own it, though.
Yes. We maintain it. One thing, obviously open concept is not a new. This particular slide was found. It was from 1970s. It was the state office building, and that's what it looked like, 1970. We'll go to the next slide. And this kind of gives us the recent history of lease cost. Where this concern comes up is as we've grown with our lease cost in the matter of 11 years have gone up $15 million. With our private leases, the most expensive lease we have in the state is in Anchorage at $3.75. Juneau, our most expensive private lease is $2.86. Nome, it's $3. And Fairbanks, it's $2.63. State leases, the state office building costs us $2.06 to maintain that. That's what we charge the agencies in that building. The Atwood building is $1.56. When you look at when you add the parking garage onto it, it's 33 cents. So roughly $1.89 is what the Atwood cost the state to operate. In this particular case, we have one agency, DNR, that we're working on with space standards. We believe, working with them, that if they were to implement space standards, they would see a change in their operating budget of over $1 million once all the floors had new space standards. And that is after the expenses of doing it. It's just we have very inefficient use of space in some of our offices.
Representative Reinbold.
Okay, I'm going to jump back just a slide, but it's slide number 23. I tried to catch you when you were at the bottom, but you're pretty darn fast. Okay, so basically what I want to know is there's 1,623,000 square foot, the Department of Administration manages. Basically, when you implement these new standards, mm-hmm. what is our total space going to be? And then I'll have a follow-up.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, with the space that we own with these 17 buildings and this $1.6 million square feet, what we're looking at doing in that is reducing the footprint of some of our departments and divisions that are currently in it, so we can collapse private leases into state-owned facilities that are cheaper to maintain and operate.
Okay, so as a follow-up, so we'll still own it. You're just going to do private leases. So
No, through the chair, what we're doing for example, in the Atwood building, mm-hmm. we believe that when we completely have space standards applied in the Atwood building, which is going to take several years, like 4 or 5 years mm-hmm. to do it, depending on funding, mm-hmm. But with that, there's going to be enough space that we can collapse a private lease into that building. And what I mean by that is we have leases in Anchorage where we believe we're going to save about 40,000 square feet. We're going to be able to take a private lease where we're paying $3 or $3.50 a square foot and put those people in the Atwood building at $1.89 a square foot. So the savings is the delta between what it costs us to maintain our building and what that private lease is.
Okay, so I'll go back through the chair of my original question. What's the total lease space going to be? What do you see the reductions you know, in, because I'll tell you, just as a funny little example, in the Capitol, just because your office gets smaller doesn't mean our total, you know, if you catch where I'm going with that.
Okay. Well,
that's kind of what I'm trying to figure out.
Through the chair, we charge the agencies that are in standalone facilities for their actual square footage. Mm-hmm. So what their footprint is what they get charged, the $1.89, for example, in the Atwood building. It's not split equally among divisions in the floor. It's their actual square footage. And so that's where the savings comes up, is we can, you know, like I said, with DOT, with DNR collapsing from 9 floors to 3 floors, to 6 floors, that's going to free up 3 empty floors in the Atwood building. And then we would look at one of our more expensive leases as it comes due to move them into that vacant space and not have that lease out there anymore, that private lease.
Okay, and just as a final wrap up to this, the reason I'm asking this is because it just seems like when I grew up here, there was a lot of malls, there was a lot of private sector buildings, and it seems like either the school district or the municipality or the state have bought up our malls. They just, you know, we just have so many buildings, and if there's a way we can do something, you know, to streamline some of this, and the state does not pay any property taxes, is that correct?
That is
so
correct.
We're also impacting, you know, at a municipal level. I probably don't want to know the answer to this question, but do you know how many total square feet the state owns for all of our buildings?
Through the chair, I don't, and the reason I don't is we maintain, the Department of Administration owns and operates 17 buildings.
Got it.
DOT does facilities, and so they have other buildings. We primarily own and operate office buildings, and they do warehouses, public facilities, you know, other buildings across the state. So they would have to, and we can find that number out from Department of Transportation, or Department of, or from DOT, to find out what their facility square footage is. But their buildings are different than our type of buildings. They don't necessarily manage office space. And that's our responsibility.
Love that information. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
On page 27, as I kind of discussed earlier, we do an evaluation. We look at the potential impact of space standards. We review it. We do analysis. We manage it by case by case. One thing that we've done, and I think this has gone very well, we work, you know, my office works very closely with the other department, and we work with that commissioner, and it's not a vacuum where DOT or DOA comes in and says, you will implement space standards, this is your square footage, and this is what your space is going to look like. We actually work with the individual departments because they come to us because there's a cost savings, or we go to them and say, we think we can save you money. Case in point is Department of Corrections on the 18th floor of the Atwood building. We went to them. They wanted to implement space standards. We worked with them on the layout. What layout do you need? What conference rooms do you need? What phone rooms do you need for your employees? We gave the building had a building conference room. We gave that to them. What they were able to do was they were able to consolidate. They were on the 6th floor, the 12th floor, the 18th floor, and had a private lease. When we did space standards, they got rid of their space on the 6th and 12th floor. They put everybody on the same floor, and they collapsed a private lease. And so for them, there was just an not only did they save money, but there was an efficiency of pulling out 4 groups that were scattered into one office. And so we look at the mission of the agency, the interface, obviously, with the public. I'll wait to the next slide. And then we have, I'm sorry, I jumped ahead. Employee needs, what does the employee, and also the parking, what parking is needed for the facility. Douglas Island here, we're doing a complete gutter remodel of that. The legislature has funded that. It's an $18 million project. Once we do space layout, we can accommodate another 20 employees in there. We can move another agency into that facility. We didn't have the parking. So we reached out, we negotiated actually with the harbor, and we've got 40 new parking spots at Douglas. They've always had an issue with parking. We've looked at it. We were able to look at that. Current lease terms is something that we look at. And again, if there's not a return on the investment, we don't do it. And we work with the commissioner's office to do it, to help determine their needs. One thing that we found, too, which is kind of a side note, this is the Atwood building. We walked through the Atwood building to see what was there. We found 78 dorm room refrigerators, not in break rooms. We found 67 microwaves, not in break rooms. another 55 small refrigerators, and 13 avocado green refrigerators during remodels where people would haul them in and put them up in their offices.
Are you sure this wasn't a college dorm?
No, this is the Atwood building, a Class A office building. Needless to say, oh, and two George Foreman grills. So if you think an employee had a microwave, a refrigerator, and George Foreman grills, not in break rooms. And that's one thing that we're doing is we do space standards in the Atwood. We're giving the employees a break room, which they don't have right now. It's a small closet. Now we're giving 500-square-foot break rooms where they have their microwaves, the dishwasher, the refrigerator, and they're not allowed to have these items at their desk. There's not room for these items at their desk. They have correct coffee pots now, so we don't have everybody having coffee pots at their desk. And so this was something, you know, holiday lights. We found crock pots, humidifiers, all kinds of stuff. Well, they draw energy. They pop fuses. And with the old furniture, sometimes the cubicles caught on fire.
Representative Herron.
Commissioner, has the third floor implemented this strategy of allowed and restricted?
I
refuses to come or pleading the fifth.
Yeah, no. Through the chair, Representative Herron, I can't necessarily for the third floor here. They do have a break room, and I'm unaware of anything outside. I haven't patrolled after hours like we did in the Atwood building to see what was in the building that we had. I will say one thing with the governor's office. When we looked at space standards, we have the new systems furniture, and then also for commissioners and directors and deputy commissioners, there is a desk. Or a sample of a desk and type of credentials you can order, which is space standard, certain color, certain size, and that. The governor has space standards furniture in his Fairbanks office. So they have implemented space standards.
Paula?
So, Mr. Commissioner, so you may suggest to the Labor and Commerce Chair that the legislature look at this red box for our floors?
Through the chair, so noted.
I think the committee is considering a George Foreman grill.
I know what you are.
Grill class.
Representative.
Thank you. I appreciate your hard work on this. Has it impacted morale at all?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, very good point. One thing that we have done is after an employee group has been in the space, usually about 3 months, mm-hmm. we go back and we do a survey of those employees. Mm-hmm. You know, what do they like about it, what they don't like about it, what are some of the changes that we can do, what are some of their concerns. Case in point was in Anchorage. We had done sliding pocket doors on the telephone rooms, so employees, if they had personal calls or fighting with their teenagers, they can go into the room, close the door. They were pocket doors we had installed. Well, when the pocket doors closed, it left a void so you could hear what was going on in the room. So we have now since gone back, and now they have regular swing doors, and they don't have that, and we've insulated a little bit better. So we've learned from it, and we do, and we've done polling, I didn't say polling, but surveying of our employees to help understand some of their concerns in that, so we can kind of improve it as we go along. So yes, we have done it. The other thing too is with these new system furniture, the acoustical panels are a little bit more than 30-year-old panels. So some of the there's a little bit noise dampening, but also with some of the layouts, we're trying to place some of the conference rooms in areas that it kind of allows for some of the noise not to be there, just on placement of certain offices.
Okay. I mean, I'm trying to remember, if I may, from my American history teaching and reading, if it was Frederick Law Olmsted, I can't remember the gentleman's name, from the late 1800s. Who would measure how many brush strokes it took to sweep a floor, and if you took 32, you should have taken 31. And I mean, this is a famous historical figure. But I hope we're not getting that sort of draconian, and we're allowing for some personality to affect the office place.
Through the chair, not by any, by no means. You know, one thing that was a concern early is that we were going to restrict personal effects in their cubicle. By all means, you want to have the picture of the family, you want to have plants, that's your function. One thing that we are not having is aquariums. We have 30 and 40 gallon aquariums in some of our offices. So, but no, that's one thing is we're listening to the employees, but we're very flexible, and that's something else with us. You know, where people sit, how they want to do it, and the one thing with the systems furniture is it's universal in the sense that the employees can decide if they want to have overhead bins or if they want to have up down top down desk where they can hit a button and you know they can stand up at the end of the day and work at their computer or lower. Those are all customizations for the employees, because the one thing that we don't have in a lot of our buildings is ergonomically correct furniture. And so we're trying to address that at the same time. But again, the one thing I think is really important to note, we're not looking for, you know, we have not asked for capital funds to do this. This is agency funds that they normally would have purchased systems furniture with. Mm-hmm. In some cases, they've been able to use a federal grant. Child Support Services did that. Where they were able to buy furniture that way. Also, we've worked with the bond bank that they can get up to a 10-year note, an agency can, at 3% mm-hmm. money to purchase the systems furniture. So, for example, you know, if it's $300,000 worth of systems furniture, it's $30,000 a year or $32,000. They can budget for it. Mm-hmm. So there's different creative ways we've looked at how we could pay for this and not being a large capital expense. Case in point, over in Enterprise Technologies, ETS, over in the State Office Building, we looked at the footprint of what they had for space. Mm-hmm. We found that they have space for 30 empty PCNs. If they had implemented space standards, they get a break room and 30 empty cubicles. So what it is we don't know, we can readjust our employees as agencies grow or shift. They can do this. And the same thing, too, is when you go from one work environment to the other, it's the same furniture. It's all mix and match in that sense. And so that's an advantage that we're having. I'll wrap up fairly quickly. This is the fourth floor of the Atwood building. Some of the changes we had 75 appliances on that floor. There are 8, and they all belong in the cafe. And this is where we used federal dollars, primarily federal funding, to do this. But they gained training rooms. They gained large conference rooms. Next slide. This is a little bit before and after the above. You can kind of see how the old cubicles were and the way they were placed around the window, and that was their break room. On the top slide, down below, these are the same, standing in the same locations, how open it is. You can see out the windows. And then also the break room, how now they go right to the windows. It lets the natural light in. People can go in there, have their potlucks, have their meals, and it be a place that they actually, they've enjoyed and commented on very positively on the break rooms. The 18th floor, we've talked about this. This was the corrections where they had 19 private offices, went down to 8 private offices, went from 23 workstations to 43. They have large conference rooms, and the appliance count 37. They're down to 0. They were able to use agency funds. Next slide. The little bit before and after. This is where it was all offices, and now it's rather open. But if you look wherever the picture is taken, you can see daylight. The employees can get natural light. And the Atwood has the best views in Anchorage, so it's really nice space. This is the seventh floor. This is where we can do the tour of this facility.
Sorry. Representative Chenault. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you're right. Part of the Atwood building you can see has better views of Alaska. You can almost see God's country from there.
We can see Kenai.
If you look south.
This one is, I think this is the building that we've talked about looking at, the seventh floor of the State Office Building. This one's interesting because there were a total of, what we have, there were 12 windows that were only available to 4 staff because they had private offices. After it was done, all 24 windows was available for staff because we had one private office, which was the director, and it moved to the interior. Of that, and the appliance count went down from 4 to 0. We went from 5 private offices down to 1, included another break room, or not another break room, but another conference room for these particular employees. This is the before and after of that picture. You can see above what it looked like last year, and by this summer, that's what it looked like below. Where we have the two people standing by those windows are representative right above. You can kind of see it was a little hard to see through them with the amount of stuff there. The one thing, too, I will say Space Standards has done, it has really decluttered departments. They found that they no longer need the administrative manual from 1978 on the bookshelf. It is really, we in some of these locations, they brought up literally dumpsters worth of material and purged it and put stuff into archives, which is huge. Funding, which this we've talked about, operating funds. Another one is if it's a lease building, we can amortize that within the monthly lease rate. And then also there's a savings in the reduce of lease space. If you're using less space and you have a savings, you can use that savings to help offset the furniture cost or help pay for it out of the line of credit. And one thing we have done for all of our employees, everything is on the website. The space standards analysis, whether you look at the manual, space that we've looked at, we've moved on by, we've looked at it, we've done analysis, either it qualifies or doesn't, it's all listed for the employees to see. And with that, I will take any other questions that you might have.
Questions on space standards? Well, it looks like you got enough time to give us a few minutes on an update on the conversion from Blue Cross to Aetna.
I can do that. I can do that.
It looks like Mike Barnhill to do it. I see him sitting in the back row.
Oh, Mike's. Well, I'm going to do it because Mike can't do one thing. Mike helped with it. Mike has done this transition. He's done a marvelous job. This contract here, moving from HealthSmart over to Aetna and moving about 84,000 active employees and retirees, went out to bid. We had four people bid on it, and it was a $100 million contract, and we did not have one protest, which is huge when you look at something of this magnitude. And Mike and his team was key to that. I was just able to kind of watch from afar from last year as this was moving through the process. One thing I think it's important to note is the state of Alaska spends $600 million a year on medical claims for its retirees and for its active employees that are not in union trust. And the component this year, one of the deciding components when they did the RFP was to reprice all four vendors that were bidding on this, repriced in their network what our medical costs would be. And that was one of the major criterias for awarding that bid. Aetna won it. They believe conservatively that they could have saved the state, based on the plan year that we gave them, $50 million over what we were paying. We'll see if that comes to fruition. We've just made that transition January 1st, but it's a huge number when you look at when we pay $600 million out. Ironically, 5 years ago or 4 years ago when we did the RFP, their general criteria was the plan administrator, who's our third party, who's paying these health claims, which are $30,000 a month. What was their cost? How much, you know, we were trying, the plan administrator, we were trying to hold them to the lowest cost. We never addressed the $600 million. So this year they changed it and said, we're going to reprice, how much can you save out of the $600 million? And of course, what you charge us is also part of the bid, but we're more focused on what your network is. And this is where Aetna came forward and potentially believes that they could have saved us in that plan year $50 million.
I think the only question I've heard since the conversion went into place is that in the smaller communities like mine and Representative Chenault's, we don't have a lot of doctors and a lot of dentists, and I think we have one internist and one dentist so far that have signed up to be in the network. I believe the hospital, our only hospital has signed up, but it's slow. But I think there might be other dynamics in play, like what's going on with Obamacare, and you know, the doctors are probably hesitant to jump into something that was Mike. Come on up, Mike.
Yeah, Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner. He's been handling this day in and day out with Aetna and with that, and I think he could probably.
Can you read yourself onto the record, Mike, please?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Administration. Network issues for our health insurance plans have been a problem for us for decades, really. And when you've got a small market like Alaska has, with not much competition amongst providers, many providers ask themselves, what is the benefit to me to get into a network where I have to do a couple things, negotiate a discount for my fees and abide by whatever standards the third-party administrator or network provider is imposing on me. Our hope is that through Aetna, providers will recognize the benefit to themselves and to their members by getting into the network. And I've been impressed with Aetna's representatives over the past couple months as they've reached out to providers across the state to look to creating win-wins for providers and Aetna to get into network. Now in Juneau, when Aetna started last fall, there wasn't any major providers in network. We now have three primary care practices in network, including a pediatrics practice, and we have Bartlett Hospital, and that's pretty big because we've not had Bartlett Hospital fully in network ever, to my understanding. So to the extent that you have providers in your communities that aren't in network, a couple of important things to know. At this point, we're not penalizing either any of our active employees and dependents or retirees and dependents for going out of network to get care. That's very common in the lower 48. Usually there's a net out of network differential. So the insurance company in the lower 48 will reimburse 60% of an allowed cost in the lower 48 as opposed to 80% or 90% if you stay in network. And that's what drives members into network to get care. We don't do that in our plan, and we don't do it primarily because we don't have fully robust networks across Alaska, but we'd really like to get there, and my hope is that we will get there soon.
Any questions for Mike or Curtis?
We would encourage, if you have concerns from your constituents regarding the transition, we'd encourage you to pass those along to us. Aetna's been very responsive in acting on those concerns. There's no shortage of concerns. People take their health care coverage very, very seriously. Any changes are, for some, viewed as a potential hardship. That was not the intention of doing this, but we will consider all concerns seriously.
Representative Reinbold.
Okay. We're definitely doing a huge transition. Obviously, in the Obamacare arena, how is it affecting overall Alaska, the residents, the business, the state employees, anybody? What kind of impacts? And my understanding is about 3 million nationwide, and I believe it's 3,000 Alaskans have signed up.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Reinbold. Our retiree plan is not directly subject to the Affordable Care Act, and our active plan is subject in part. Our active plan is what's called a grandfathered plan, so we can maintain current plan design if we don't make certain changes to our cost structure. I think, however, it's hard to overstate the impact that the Affordable Care Act has had in the medical marketplace throughout the country and in Alaska. And I can just rattle off a few of the ways that the Affordable Care Act has impacted our plans, even though they're not directly fully subject to a variety of the Affordable Care Act provisions. I think first is it impacts expectations for coverage. And so the Affordable Care Act has imposed a variety of expectations for coverage, particularly for older members in our retiree plan. We're now supposed to, under the Affordable Care Act, cover dependents up to age 26. Now, our retiree plan isn't legally subject to that provision, but many of our members would like coverage to be expanded so it covers their up to age 26 dependents. And we've engaged in discussion with our retirees over whether we should expand our plan coverages to include that. And we may make some changes down the line. But I think one of the things to understand is whenever you expand coverage, either because you know folks expect under federal law that they should have the same benefits, it costs. And so what we're trying to do is communicate with all of our stakeholders that expanding coverage costs the state and the trust funds more money. We want folks to understand that. there's, you know, just additional restrictions that if we lose grandfather status, that we would have to put into our plan, into our active plan, and that's something that we're looking at. And then finally, the another big aspect of the Affordable Care Act is, even though we're not entirely subject to its coverage provisions, we are subject to some of its taxing provisions. So we are contributing fees for the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute. It's a $2 a head fee. And then we're also going to be contributing a reinsurance fee at $63 a head for at least the first year, and then it grades down to $25 a head in the third year. And so these are additional financial burdens that are put on our plans that we seek funding for from the legislature in order to comply with the Affordable Care Act.
Follow up. Okay, lots of alarms there. First of all, what do you project the costs are going to be if we add on those 26 and under? And we'll start then.
So the costs, we've made that change in the active plan. That was one of the changes we had to make. We've not made the change in the retiree plan because it's not required. The cost of doing that. Our actuary had originally thought that it was going to be quite a bit more expensive, and then they reduced the projected cost. I don't have the numbers, but I can share the actuarial letter. Whether it's a little bit of costs or a big cost, the point is still the same, and that is we're very reluctant to add any costs to our retiree plan because it's so underfunded. And so one aspect of the discussion with the retirees is, well, okay, if you want enhanced benefits, you want age 26 coverage, or you want preventive care, which isn't covered right now, or you want shingles vaccines, how are we going to pay for that without increasing the burden to the state and the unfunded liability? There are a variety of ways to do that. We could potentially raise deductibles. That's something that we've talked about with retirees. Increase out-of-pocket maximums, decrease other coverages that perhaps retirees are not wedded to. But that's an important discussion to have, regardless of whether it's a big or a little cost.
Okay, and through the chair. Okay, so a couple other things. One, how many retirees do we have out of state? And number two, can you explain to me this $2 per head per market-based something?
Sure. We have close to 42,000 retirees in our public employees retirement system and teachers retirement system. And on the books, about 40% of those live out of state. Based on where they're getting their medical care, we think that it's possible that maybe 50% actually live out of state. And that's something that we need to look into because the folks that live in state get a cost of living adjustment. And so there may be some concerns about how many folks are actually qualified to get that cost of living adjustment. With respect to your second question, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute is an entity that I believe was created by the Affordable Care Act as an entity, a federal corporate entity that will research, take the money from this $2 a head tax and do research on patient-centered outcomes. It's a
One last one.
A healthcare research entity.
So you're asking the state to fund a federal program. Is that what I'm hearing here?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I personally am not asking the state to do anything except comply with the federal law that has been imposed upon us.
Okay. But basically that's what it's doing, if I'm hearing you correctly. The state's going to be paying for a federal, I mean, if you make this request, who's making this decision and when is it going
to
be made?
It's responding to a mandate.
It is a federal mandate to pay this tax.
We don't have a choice. Representative Chenault, any last questions?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Josephson.
Just that, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You can have the speaker's question too, if you want it.
Well, I'm not sure what his would be. But for Mr. Barnhill, the letter you referred to, I actually have a bill that Senator Davis had run, and I'm carrying, at least nominally. Not much is happening with it. But relative to the under 26-year-old children of retirees, if there's a recent actuarial letter about that, I'd love to see that as well.
Through the chair, the letter I referred to actually may have been prepared for your bill, so it may be on basis. We'll pull it up and and make sure that all of you have it.
Well, thank you again, gentlemen, and support people and everybody that stuck it out for an hour and 45 minutes. And, with that, we'll adjourn at 4:45.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.